We are in 2 Samuel chapter 21. I'll open up with a prayer if you don't mind. Almighty God, our Father in heaven, we ask your blessing upon today's service, that you will bless our thoughts and bless our understanding and bless our conversations, so we're able to comprehend more of you, understand where you directed us to do and to learn, that we follow your will and follow your path that you've written for us. Continue to provide for us and instruct us accordingly, God. We praise and thank you, Jesus, on Yeshua HaMashiach. Amen. We're in 2 Samuel chapter 21.
Now there was a famine in the days of David for 3 years, year after year, and David inquired of the Lord. And the Lord answered, "It is because of Saul and his bloodthirsty house, because he killed the Gibeonites." So the king called the Gibeonites and spoke to them. Now the Gibeonites were not of the children of Israel, but of the remnant of the Amorites. The children of Israel had sworn protection to them, but Saul had sought to kill them in his zeal for the children of Israel and Judah. Therefore David said to the Gibeonites, "What shall I do for you, and what shall I make atonement, that you may bless the inheritance of the Lord?" And the Gibeonites said to him, "We will have no silver or gold from Saul or from his house, nor shall you kill any man in Israel for us." So he said, "Whatever you say, I will do for you." Then they answered the king, "As for the man who consumed us and plotted against us, that we should be destroyed from the remaining in any of the territories of Israel, let 7 men of his descendants be delivered to us, and we will hang them before the Lord in Gibeah of Saul, whom the Lord chose." And the king said, "I will give them." But the king spared Mephibosheth, the son of Jonathan, the son of Saul, because of the Lord's oath that was between them, between David and Jonathan, the son of Saul. So the king took Armoni and Mephibosheth, the 2 sons of Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah, whom she bore to Saul, and the 5 sons of Michal, the daughter of Saul, whom she brought up for Adriel, the son of Barzillai, the Mahalathite. And he delivered them into the hands of the Gibeonites, and they hanged them on the hill before the Lord. So they fell, all 7 together, and were put to death in the days of harvest, in the first days in the beginning of barley harvest. Now Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah, took sackcloth and spread it for herself on the rock, and the beginning of harvest until the late rains poured on them from heaven. And she did not allow the birds of the air to rest on them by day, nor the beast of the field by night. And David was told what Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah, the concubine of Saul, had done. Then David went and took the bones of Saul and the bones of Jonathan his son from the men of Jabesh Gilead, who had stolen them from the street of Beth-shan, where the Philistines had hung them up after the Philistines had struck them down, Saul in Gilboa. So he brought up the bones of Saul and the bones of Jonathan his son from there, and they gathered the bones of those who had been hanged. They buried the bones of Saul and Jonathan his son in the country of Benjamin in Zelah, in the tomb of Kish his father. So they performed all that the king commanded, and after that God heeded the prayer for the land. When the Philistines were at war again with Israel, David and his servants with him went down and fought against the Philistines, and David grew faint. Then Ishbi-benob, who was one of the sons of the giant, the weight of whose bronze spear was 300 shekels, who was bearing a new sword, thought he could kill David. But Abishai, the son of Zerulah, came to his aid and struck the Philistine and killed him. Then the men of David swore to him, saying, "You shall go out no more with us to battle, lest you quench the lamp of Israel." Now it happened afterward that there was again a battle with the Philistines at Gob. Then Sibekai the Hishathite killed Saph, who was one of the sons of the giant. Again there was war at Gob with the Philistines, were Ehalana, the son of Jerah's Oregim, the Bethlehemite, killed the brother of Goliath, the Gittite, the shaft of whose spear was like a weaver's beam. Yet again there was a war at Gath, where there was a man of great stature, who had 6 fingers on each hand and 6 toes on each foot, 24 in number. And he also was born to the giant. So when he defied Israel, Jonathan the son of Shimei, David's brother, killed him. These 4 were born to the giant in Gath, and fell by the hand of David and by the hand of his servants.
That was 2 Samuel chapter 21. Any comments or questions regarding this particular chapter? It obviously includes a payment back for Saul's actions that cost 7 innocent lives. It also, of course, includes the death of the remainder, at least I shouldn't say the remainder, the death of at least 4 additional descendants of the giant, along with, of course, Goliath being the 5th one, who had died first. Any comments or issues with this chapter?
Is the woman Michal the one that David first married?
There is a error in 2 Samuel 21. This is not due to our translations. Actually, the error is in Hebrew. Michal was not married to this particular individual. Her older sister, Merav, was. In 1 Samuel 18, it discusses that her older sister, Merav, was supposed to be given to David as his wife. But Saul's last moment switched and gave her to Adriel instead. She was the one who was married to Adriel. Michal was married to a totally different man who didn't have any children, and she was returned to David when David became king. So the recording here of Michal being the mother of these 5 sons is actually incorrect. First Chronicles verifies that this is incorrect, that in fact that there were 5 sons, but from Merav, not from Michal. Michal wasn't married to this gentleman, and she didn't have children. David never knew her as a wife. There should be, I believe there is. Let me double check. It should be, oh crud. I forgot where it is. Anyway, sorry, David, go ahead. Your question was? Your comment?
Yes, the 2 ones that were supposedly spared or set aside, Armoni and Mephibosheth, they're mentioned as the 2 sons, and then they added 5, and then they go ahead and say again the 7 were hung. It sounds like initially they were setting them apart so that they wouldn't be killed, but it sounds like they are a part of the 7 that
were
are
killed. Right. There's the way the English is written versus the Hebrew is written is a little bit different, and it's, hence there's a slight odd in the wording there. What actually appears to have happened, was that there were 2. Mephibosheth was the son of Jonathan was set aside. He was not to be killed, but that was Mephibosheth, son of Jonathan, not Mephibosheth, the son of Saul. Because Saul had a son through Rizpah, a concubine, also named Mephibosheth. 2 different men. One was a grandchild of Saul, and the other was actually the son of Saul with the same first name. So it's a little bit confusing. So Mephibosheth, the son of Saul, who was through Rizpah, him and his brother, the 2 sons, they were killed. But the one of Jonathan was set aside. He was one that was spared. So those 2 through Rizpah, and then, of course, the 5 other grandchildren through Merav were also 5 sons, say. I'm not sure how many daughters she may have had and doesn't record that. They were killed. Of course, their names I don't believe are even listed here. Yes, Purin.
Well, it's something about the number 6, because I've always wondered why they actually made that detail aware in the story. But when I did a study about truth in Hebrew, the numbers added up to 9, and the numbers for falsehood, it added up to 6. and six was not a significant number in Hebrew gematria, I guess. So I was wondering if there's any connection.
To the number six, I do not know a connection to number six. Vav, right, but as far as symbolism associated to it within the Torah. Other than, obviously 6 days of creation is the seventh day of rest, but that's, for the most part, that's the only one that I know of regarding six in particular. I do know that people commonly associate number six as with man, because man was created on the sixth day. But then again, so are all the animals too. So that's debatable there. But I don't have an answer for you on the number six. You did mention briefly in the kitchen earlier regarding number five, which I would like to talk about, finally, because that would be more interesting today, to me personally, of course. But that was more a different conversation. But number six, I don't have an answer for you regarding that. Any other comments or questions regarding this particular chapter? Well, I have a question. Maybe you can answer it. It's a question that I'm sure some of you thought about, but you just opted to not say anything. How is it fair, just, or right, that God would say, okay, person A, known as Saul, is a murderer. He is God, and God kills him, executes him, along with most of his sons. But a particular crime that he did, Saul is already dead. I need to find somebody else to kill to pay for that crime. And so it goes and takes seven of that man's descendants, who were, in most cases, not even born yet. I'm going to execute those seven for this man's crime over here. And that will pay for it. What did those seven do? What were they responsible? What portion of the crime were they guilty for? Why? And note, by the way, it is commonly believed this particular execution, though we don't have the exact date, occurs sometime after David is fully king, meaning responsible for all of Israel, so at least when he's in Jerusalem, not in Hebron, because he has control, of course, the descendants of Saul. So it is at minimum 7.5 years to 8 years after Saul's death, at minimum. In these cases, more than likely, most Jewish commentators consider about 30 years after Saul's death. Yes, Bill.
Would that fall under the sins of the father?
It would fall under the sins of the father to some extent. That's true. Well, the sins of the father, of course. How far does God take those sins? Yes, David.
Yes, but doesn't Torah say that the sins of the father will not be passed on, or the child will not be responsible for the father's, or the father responsible for the son's?
That's true. See, God punishes, meaning gives the effects of a sin. I will curse those who curse me in the third and fourth generation. So that happens, and they do pay for their father's sins in that fashion. However, we're not paying, in the case, for example, one could argue that Saul did a crime. His children pay for it, and that are they to be executed for that crime, or do they pay for it, meaning the loss of something else? They lost their father, clearly, or their grandfather, depending on who they happen to be, and they lost, obviously, the right to the kingdom. So it's debatable. It's a complex question. Yes, Ellie?
Did the crime continue?
The continued execution?
The crime of what Saul did. If sin can follow a family, and those seven guys may have been equally guilty as lineage of Saul.
Conceivable, but then you have to ask yourself, when did the crime occur? If those of you who work very, very hard and look at all your Bible and read it backwards and forward again and again and again, is there any record of Saul's execution of Gibeonites? No. There's no record, no example, not even a brief mention of it. See, question. When did this happen? What happened? What's the background story? Why are these seven men executed for something that their father or grandfather did, and they had no control of it at all? Nor, in their cases, did their parents, or in the case of Mirav and her husband, have any control over it at all? It's an interesting question. There is an answer, by the way. It's an interesting question. Okay. Let's discuss the crime itself. Now, if you do read all the story of Saul all over again, when did he execute a bunch of people? Well, if you recall, David, I believe, was fleeing Saul for his life, which happened quite often. He went to a town called Nob, which all the priesthood, Israelite Levitical priesthood, lived. And he said, I'm on a secret mission. Do you have any food, weapons? I gotta go. Abimelech, the high priest at the time at Nob, said, all we have is a showbread here. You're welcome to it. Make sure, as long as you haven't known any woman at all, you're holy. So yes, we haven't known any woman. He also, oh, by the way, here is Goliath's sword. Okay, I'll take that too. So he took Goliath's sword, he took obviously the showbread, and he left. If you recall, there was a particular Edomite named Doeg who was there and watched and saw David come, talk to Abimelech, receive the bread, and flee. Well, Doeg then goes to Saul, who Saul's trying to hunt David down, and says, I just saw David go to the town of Nob, which is all priestly run, priest's town, get some showbread, which means the whole temple was there at the time, and take off and leave. Saul, of course, brings Abimelech and 200 priests out and asks them and confronts them, and they say, we didn't know anything about this. We didn't know you were trying to hunt him down. He was your son-in-law. Why wouldn't we help him? Saul, of course, orders all of his men to execute these men. And all of his men say, no. I'm not touching them. I'm not going to lay a finger on them. Won't do it. So Saul says, all right, Doeg, you go kill them. So Doeg goes off and slaughters all 200. That is the only record of a priesthood execution, or at least a execution, sorry, of a group of people that we know about for Saul. Is that the same execution for the Gibeonites? Now, as you recall, it says here, the Gibeonites were not of Israel. No biological relation at all. They are the remnant of the Amorites. Now, if you recall the story about that briefly, Joshua, when he was conquering all of Canaan at the time, which turned into Israel, they defeated a bunch of people at Ai and various other groups and towns. The Gibeonites, who were Amorites at the time, tricked them. They made themselves look, they're all roughed up. Oh, we're from a far country away. You know, we're coming here. We've heard your wonderful, you know, your exploits. Here's some old stale bread that was fresh when we first baked it. Yada, yada, yada. They convinced Joshua and all the men that they were from a really far away country and that, you know, be a good cheer. Oh, wait, we'll shake hands. Oh, this will be great. We'll be friends. We'll make a treaty. Israel, Joshua, not being aware of the deception, not realizing the Gibeonites were the next town they were supposed to conquer, said, okay, fine. Yep, waited 3 days, they went home, oh, that's all great, they took off. And then when Israel comes, the Gibeonites find those men, they say, we're actually right here, you made a deal with us. Now, you can break your deal, because that's according to your will, but you did make a deal. In the name of God, the name of your God. Joshua made the determination, no, we will not break an oath. We swore in the name of our God. But you will be water carriers and wood chippers for all the congregation of Israel and the temple for the rest of your natural existence as a people. So I have a question for you. If these people known as Gibeonites, who were the descendants of Amorites, whose job was to help all the congregation of Israel conquer Canaan, which they did. Israel conquered Canaan. They helped. What happened when they finished helping with the conquering? They helped with the temple service, carrying water and supplying wood That was their function. That was their task. So, if Abimelech, being the high priest, and a large number of priest men with him, you know, working on the temple, taking care of the various things and details, in Nob, had the temple set up, we have the altar, we have the ark, we have all the various components, we need water. What do? They hire the Gibeonites, who are in two towns over. Not close enough to throw a rock, but close enough to get there within about 2 days' time. Day and a half, actually. So, do they hire one Gibeonite? Do they hire two? They probably have lots of them, huh? Because, you know, the entire town of Nob is a priest's town. So its sole function is to supply the priest's work and duties for all of Israel. Every holiday, Shabbat, all the various sacrifices. How many Gibeonites do you think probably worked in Nob? Probably hundreds. Probably. So when, as it records, Saul exterminated every man, woman, and child in Nob, priest, Levite or not, do you think Gibeonites were killed there too? Because they probably worked there. Note, if you look at the map, which I have up here, my little handy-dandy map, so I'm back to maps again. You know, there is a little piece that says Nob, and a little arrow points, this little red dot. Just south, that is Jerusalem. Just to the west of it is Gibeah, but just a little bit further is Gibeon. Gibeon is not the next town over, it's two towns over, where all the Gibeonites live. Note, it's very convenient to have a priestly town right next to all your servants, isn't it? Because you can work and get the servants to go back and forth really easily, huh? So, Nob contained all the Levites, at least the vast majority of them. And Saul executed them, including all their families, men, women, children. Which means anybody in Nob died. Now, Abimelech's son survived and ran to David. He fled. So a large number, now it says that he killed 200 priests that wore linen. Those, which in my mind would state, those are male priests, probably of the tribe of Levi. Probably. But every man, woman, and child killed in Nob, not necessarily all of them are priests in Levi. Some of them were most likely Gibeonites, who are sworn an oath not to be killed by Joshua. So this is the only real record, which I perceive is probably the correct one, discussing the extermination of a group of people who Gibeonites most likely were part of. As you recall, I probably mentioned this a number of times, Saul did a lot of bad things, and he was executed for some of them, some worse than others. But there's no record or no reason for his execution or death to ever pay for the extermination of all the priests, all of God's men, at Nob. Why not? Oh, David has the answer of why not. Because David said so. When David fled to Gath at that moment in time, Abimelech's son, I forgot his name off the top of my head, I'm going to say it's, I forgot anyway, ran and told him, by the way, Saul just exterminated my father, the high priest, and all the people of Nob. They're all dead. David's immediate response was, this is on my head. He immediately took responsibility, which means he makes the payment, not Saul. So guess who has to make the payment when the payment comes due? Roughly 30 years later, David has to select the men to make the payment that was never paid. Does that give you a background of the crime and a semi-start of our explanation of what's happening? It's bloody. It's supposed to be. Saul was bloody. So, the Gibeonites and all of Nob were completely innocent in their assistance of David, and yet they all and their families lost their lives. So Saul's seven descendants, his two sons and five grandsons, are completely innocent equally on the other side. They had no responsibility whatsoever for what Saul did. But just as the Gibeonites who were executed were not responsible for their deaths, but they had to die, Saul's descendants were not responsible for their deaths, but they had to die. Somebody has to pay for it, because the only thing that pays for murder, according to the book of Numbers, which we will read there right now, this is the book of Numbers 35. Starting in verse 29. Now these shall be a statute of judgment to you throughout your generations and all your dwellings. Whoever kills a person, the murderer shall be put to death on the testimony of witnesses. But one witness is not sufficient testimony against a person for the death penalty. Moreover, you shall take no ransom for the life of a murderer who is guilty of death, but he shall surely be put to death. And you shall take no ransom for him who has fled to his city of refuge, that he may return to dwell in the land before the death of the priest. So you shall not pollute the land where you are, for blood defiles the land, and no atonement can be made for the land except for blood. For the blood that is shed on it, except by the blood of him who shed it. Therefore, do not defile the land which you inhabit, in the midst of which I dwell, for I, the Lord, dwell among the children of Israel. That's the Torah law. So the law states, the Gibeonites, when they said, I will seek no silver, no gold from Saul's family, they're not allowed to. They know the Torah. They've been knowing it, having to observe it, whether they liked it or not, for a few hundred years now. They know what the law says. To pay for this crime, you cannot pay me with money. Now, this is they don't do that today. Now it's cash first, and we'll discuss killing if you run out of money. But that's a different story. If you look at that, their wording, the Gibeonites, the way the English words, and I'm disappointed in it, because the Hebrew quite clearly says that is not what they said. When David asked the Gibeonites in verse 3, what can I do for you and how can I atone, how can I make right this sin for the sin so you will bless the heritage of the Lord? How can I correct for this murder case? The Gibeonites replied to him, we have no silver or gold against Saul or his house. That's correct. We will not take money, silver, or gold. But unfortunately, the English incorrectly states, we will have no man put to death in Israel. That's not what it actually says. It says, and we have no man to put to death in Israel. Because Saul's already dead. We can't murder the murderer because he's already dead. And so David said, okay, you can't take money, which is right. We can't kill the murderer according to Numbers, which is right because he's dead. What do we do? And David said, all right, whatever you think is right to make correction for this, because clearly God's preventing us from having water for 3 years. We will all die if we don't correct this. What is the correction? Now, they did not say, give us every descendant of Saul to exterminate. Seven. Seven was a good number. We'll discuss that in a few minutes. Seven is what they wished. Now, they had to ask the king to do it because this is stepping outside of the Torah. The Torah doesn't say, well, if the murderer happens to already be dead, you can take his children. It doesn't say that. And they can't sit there arbitrarily go select seven of Saul's sons and kill them. It requires the king's order to do so. The king says, all right, they give us seven of his descendants and we will kill them and hang them. And they said, that's fair. That is a fair correction. All the men who died on your end probably would have had children by now as well, and they're all dead, and they can't have children either, so having seven of the murderer's descendants, it seems reasonably fair. Yes, Anne.
Okay, then what happens to the commandment the Lord says, add to, do not add to, or take from?
You're absolutely right. See, this is interesting, is that David, like I said, is stepping outside of the Torah, but the payment has to be made by somebody. Because clearly, God's bringing down a curse to it. This is called what I call messianic prophecy. It's heavily written here. Note, where does it say the Son of God has to die for all of your screw-ups? That's outside the Torah, isn't it? You don't kill the non-murderer for the murderer's actions. But yet, God said that is the only way we paid. See, God steps outside of his Torah in order to create the Messiah and execute him to pay for the Torah. It's funny, for your crimes against the Torah. It's funny, God stepped outside, and guess what? David is too. It's a strange scenario, but yet, we all depend upon it. To execute a human being who was not guilty for something that another human being did do who was guilty, you're not supposed to do that, according to the law. But innocent blood must be paid for it. Blood must be paid for a murderer's atonement. We're going to get more into that in a few, a few minutes. I'll be quick. The time's virtually up.
Now the righteousness of God, apart or outside from the Torah, is revealed. So there is, the God's act is revealed by what? Revealed by the Torah itself and the prophets.
Right. So it tells you that to be outside the Torah with your God, or in this case, King David, is not necessarily wrong in its definition. It certainly can be. A lot of things are outside the Torah which are completely evil and unacceptable and intolerable. However, when you understand the Torah as well as God does, and you understand as well as at least David comprehended something had to be paid for, stepping outside was fair. Now, David didn't select the punishment. He didn't say, I will offer this. They selected it. And they knew it couldn't be money or land. So it had to be a life. And the life of an animal isn't worth a whole lot. Not when you've just murdered a whole bunch of people. So David, I believe, fully was aware that they were going to require the life of a human being. But whose and how many, that was their shalom. Which is important why they chose seven. But we'll get there. Let's see here. So the Gibeonites said that they have no man in Israel to put to death. It's not that they will not have a man put to death. That's a different translation. It's a bad one. Because Saul was already dead. So they chose seven men. As I already mentioned before, Michal, how do you pronounce her name? Doesn't really matter. Was not married to Adriel. Her sister Miriav was. The five sons were from Miriav, not Michal. And in Chronicles, it does make that correction. I didn't write down what chapter it was. But it does point out in 2 Samuel 18, verse 19, also says that Miriav was married to Adriel, not Michal. Clearly, it's a different woman there. So, Gibeonites hung the bodies in Saul's hometown. I believe the Torah says a body will not hang at past sunset. How long were the bodies hanging for? They were hanging here, and it says, till the rains came down. And they were hung at the first part of the barley harvest. That would be Passover. They were murdered or killed. They made payment, restitution, however you want to word it. It says messianic for purpose. At Passover, or near Passover. So the first part of the barley harvest. That's when they were killed. Now, barley harvest technically is a little bit past Passover, but it's that time slot. So, when does rain come? There's early rains and latter rains, right? In Israel. It's slightly different where the pattern is, but not by a whole lot. So, does it rain at Passover? Not in Israel. The rains come before Passover. That's the whole point. So, if they're hung at roughly Passover time, maybe a few days later, maybe a week later, hard to say exactly. When do the next rains come? Fall. 6 to 7 months, these bodies hung there. It's a long time, isn't it? Is that against the Torah? But yeah, it is. It's a long time. Unacceptable as far as Torah is concerned. But yet the Gibeonites made the punishment and they decreed what it will be. Well, the flesh rots. Flesh rots. The bones eventually will come down, clearly. How much time? Yeah, eventually some parts is going to fall off. And I'm not sure which clothing they had on. I don't know. I don't want to discuss that. It's kind of morbid. So it's the rotting habits of a corpse. Yes, Jeff.
Well, since the rains were miraculously stopped,
The Bereans could have miraculously be started, and it didn't have to wait until the fall for that to happen.
Exactly. That's the next point. Thank you. A particular rabbi, I forgot his name, doesn't make a difference. He said, oh, wait a minute. If the rain stopped by God, and this is the payment to make restitution for that, why couldn't God say, the payment has been made, now rain comes? They could have been hanging up there for at least more than one night, because it says Rizpah stayed there day and night to keep the animals away and the birds away. So they did break the Torah by at least one day. But how much past that, we don't know. It says till the rain came. Now, Dave's Bible said the latter rain. That's actually true. It just says rain came down. And it says latter or early. It just says rain came down. It is interpreted in English to be latter rain, so we need a 7-month period. But that's not necessarily the case. If rain's famine started it, God can stop it. So it could have been a single day. We don't know. It doesn't say. It doesn't technically matter. The point is the payment was made at Passover time. That's what matters. Because that's what's recorded. So it could be a day. It could be months. Whatever. It is what it is. I wish to speak about Rizpah. She had two sons. Their names are mentioned. Mephibosheth, and I think it's... five sons, Arjub, daughter Rizpah. Oh, Armoni, thank you, there it is. Yes, Armoni. Armoni and Mephibosheth. Note, Rizpah, not Mirav or Michael. Michael. Whether you wish it's Mirav or Michael's, the mother of the other five, makes a difference. But Rizpah is the one who goes there and guards the bodies. She is Saul's concubine. Her two sons are there. Her two sons are there. Now Mirav, her five sons are there. Is she there mourning the loss of her sons? It's not recorded that she is. I'm sure she mourned them, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying she was a callous woman, that's not the point. The point is that it focused on Rizpah's actions, what she did. Because those actions is what influenced to David and said, and told David, all right, her love and respect for these men needs to be honored. And her actions invoked his actions to take their bodies, as well as Saul and Jonathan, and return them to their home, to their father's grave. That's her actions did so. The actions for two sons, rather than the actions for five. That is also messianic, which we're going to get there with eventually. I really will get there. Before I discuss those, now this section, of course, well, up to this point, before we go off and start killing the Philistines, are there any questions regarding this portion of it? Because this chapter is kind of broken into two different sections. There's the death of the seven sons, and there's the whole bunch of killing of Philistines. Yes, Anne.
You say that Rizpah was a concubine of David, or
no,
a concubine
Saul's concubine. She's mentioned a number of times in the Bible regarding her name and what she has done over her life period. I'm going to quickly hit the Philistines because there's some minor details. We're going to go back to discuss this in more influence, more interest. This then records, the chapter records, the death of four additional giants, all descendants of the same man, or same giant, I should say. Ripha, I pronounce his name, whether that's his first name or not, that's what he's called. So Ripha means giant in Hebrew. It rattles off a few of their names. They made war. Now, note, the deaths of these giants are not necessarily in chronological order to the history of David. Nothing here is recorded in chronological order, because chronological doesn't matter. It's subject matter that matters. Because if you read 1 Chronicles, it implies David becomes king and then goes off and they all kill all these giants. Immediately. Which isn't the case. But this records almost verbatim exactly what happened, but the placing in Chronicles is different than the placing here, And so they make it sound like it's all one massive swinging event. It's not. It's a series of events. It records here that one of the men, which his name is Lami, which is not recorded in 2 Samuel, it's recorded in Chronicles, his name, the brother of Goliath. Now in Hebrew, in this book, it doesn't actually say the word brother of, it just says the man of Goliath, which isn't Goliath, it's Lami. 1 Chronicles records Lami, it's chapter 20 if you're interested. Were the other men also brothers of Goliath? No, it says they're descendants of the giant. Not necessarily brothers of Goliath. Because Goliath was killed Goliath was killed when David was a very young man. And this one is killed when David is an old man. At least some of them were killed. Sorry, not all of them. Sorry, I shouldn't say this one. Some of them are killed when David is an old man. Some of these men. And at least Goliath was killed when David was a young man. Are they likely all brothers? Well, let's think about this. Goliath told David, you are a youth. Saul told David, you are a youth. And Goliath looked at him as a child. Saying Goliath was physically larger and obviously a well-seasoned killer at his time. If you tack on 30-plus-ish years after David becomes king, so it's roughly 40-plus years after Goliath's death, give or take, would any brother of Goliath be, you know, vibrant and willing to go to war? Well, let's see. If Goliath is probably in his mid-20s to 30s, you tack on 40 years, that makes him borderline 70. Any brother he had is probably, give or take, maybe younger brother, maybe really young brother, maybe he's in his 50s. That's still kind of old for war. That's why it doesn't necessarily mean it's chronological order. You see, it points out that David was an old man when Ish-bi-benob was a descendant, doesn't say son of, it's a descendant of the giant, wanted to kill him. It could have been Goliath's son. It could have been Goliath's nephew. It could have been any other descendant thereof, but not necessarily his brother. The only one recorded as his brother was Lemmi, which is, his name is recorded here, is recorded elsewhere. But it says, Lemmi was killed, by Elion, son of Yari-Orgim, the Bethlehemite, struck down the brother Goliath, this is verse 19, who had a spear like a shaft, a weaver's beam. So, Lemmi, he was killed, Goliath's brother, and it actually says brother. The remaining of them are not called brothers of Goliath. Well, if they were all brothers of Goliath, wouldn't it say all brothers of Goliath? It doesn't. It says only one of them is a brother. The rest of them are just descendants of the same father. Who knows how many wives the man had? Yeah, he had family, he had multiple children. And it could be grandchildren, it could be other sons, who knows? Boys are not brothers. And they were all killed at different times. At least one's killed when David's an old man. And one, Goliath, of course, killed when David's a young man. So we know there's generational differences here. That's the only thing I want to talk about the sons of, other than the fact that makes five deaths of giants recorded in Samuel during David's lifetime. Those are not the only giants ever killed. There's actually Caleb killed a few, and so did his son-in-law, killed a few when they were conquering Canaan as well. So there are other giants also from the same father, Roth the giant. 400 years earlier. So, I don't think Roth lived 400 years and had a whole bunch of sons. He probably had sons early on and they all had children. That's more likely what occurred because he's still flesh and blood human being. So, unless he lived that long, it's not likely. These are probably all the same. They're just the same family line all along the Philistines. Or at least that group, they affiliated themselves with them. Okay. Any questions regarding the death of the Philistines? I'm going to run through this last bit rather quickly. My little chart up here, you got most of that. That's great. I'm going to erase some of it. Because this map just shows you what happened with Nob, Gibeon, and Gibeon. Where? What was that? Oh, Gore.
No, Gore.
Door. Oh, gosh. Dun-dun-dun. Sorry, you lost me there at first. I was a little slow. There is door. Yes, actually, it's there. Actually, yeah, that's it. Door. It's not next to door, not next to knob, but it's a door. Yes.
Where's the hinges?
Yes, the doorknob. Yes, the hinges. Yeah, we'll work on the hinges and the door jam later. The door of knob got locked on. Okay, this is my map. I thought it would be important to read. Oh, I don't think I have time to write it all down, but I'll do what I can. What messianic stuff did you see in this chapter? Well, when you see the number 3 and you see death, we're talking about Messiah somewhere. Is the number 3 in this chapter? How many years of famine they have? 3 years. So there's number 3. Did anybody die in this chapter? Oh, yeah, I believe 7 of them died in this chapter. 7 dead. This is where it gets interesting, actually. I think God has a very good sense of humor. The payment was famine, right? That's lack of water, isn't it? What was it giving its job? Bring water. God's got a sense of humor. You take water away from me, I will take it away from you. What is water, by the way? Life. So we have water / life removed for 3 years. How long was the Messiah dead for? 1, 2, 3. Oh, look, life was gone for 3 days. What did Messiah call himself? I am the life, yes. You come from me, your water, living water will come out of you, your belly, blah, 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 all the various stuff. All the various symbolism is associated with this. There's far more than just this. There's a lot more to this. God was quite interesting when he did this. So, now, David brought the sin of the death upon himself, didn't he? Even though he wasn't guilty. So we have in this story the fulfillment of David, or we'll put death, on to, little arrow, innocent people, both the 7 dead men as well as David himself. Again, messianic symbolism going on within the same chapter. Death, what was the method of death by these 7? Hanging. On tree, or something that was like a tree, on display. Sound familiar? Yeah, that'd be the Messiah's death process. No, they were all descendants of the king. Ooh, interesting. Messiah, descendant of king. So we'll say, kings. descendant. I can't spell very well on the fly. Oh, well, close enough. I couldn't spell it even I was trying really hard. Okay. See, and what was the response? Oh, sorry, Ellie, you had a question?
Well, is there a verse 10? Rizpah does what? Doesn't she do what Abraham did?
Because hold on. Read verse 10.
There's
Rizpah, daughter of Ai, took sackcloth, put it for herself over a rock.
And she kept the birds of the air and the beasts off. Isn't that a covenantal thing like Abraham did?
That is absolutely true. She does something that I liken it a little bit different. You're absolutely right. It's Abraham. You're right. It's a covenantal thing that she's action that she's doing that she's similar she's using. But note, these are all descendants of Benjamin, right? Who is Benjamin descendant of? Who's his mom? What's the prophecy? Rachel mourns for her children, right? Right.
They have no way home without
the because they're doomed to die. No, note. Mirav does not, but Rizpah does. Rizpah, to me, I perceive her as associating closer to Rachel because of her actions. Sackcloth is mourning. She's mourning. There's no hope for her children. They're done. Her only sons she had. Well, she may have had daughters, but she had 2 sons just like Rachel did, which I think is the reason why there's 2 and there's 5, which we'll talk about later, Puran. I want to repeat the question, what's 2 and what's 5? She has 2 sons, just like Rachel did, descendants of Benjamin, descendants of Rachel. She mourns for the death of her children, just as Rachel's supposed to mourn for the death of her children. So there's a mass association there. So within this, we have, which I wrote down earlier, but that's all right. So we'll put Rizpah slash Rachel mourns, which is interesting, she'd mourn the same style that Abraham did. Because Abraham's deal, when he made with God, and God took this whole scenario with these animals splitting and you're walking through them, blah, 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 blah. That was a deal, to my mind, between the animals that were killed, or sure the animals were killed, is that God's taking ownership, because Abraham was put to sleep. God's taking control of this. God will take care of Abraham's, all of his descendants. So I think she did it in a fashion that God, with Abraham, did, that God's saying, they're all dead. They are mine, don't worry about it, type of thing. So it's a racial mourns like Abraham. We'll do A, B, it takes too long to write. Okay, there's more to this. Oh, when God's son died, what did God then do?
Earthquake
was the immediate response. Darkness. But what was the blessing that came? What was the blessing that came? He resurrected. Rain. What came down? What it was poured out like water upon all mankind? His spirit. What came down at the death of these seven men?
Rain.
So rain is the blessing or result of fixing a correction of it, slash spirit. For correction. Or to pay payment. To fix all the problems, the various issues that were going on. So he fixed it by the same style. He's using these symbols again and again and again. Isn't it brilliant? He's quite talented. Okay. This part I love the most. So, Israel, all of David's descendants, all the whole countryside, is cleansed by this action, right? They are no longer guilty. They're no longer paying for Saul's actions. What was that? The land is healed. Now, she's cleansed by Gentiles associated to the priesthood by killing someone. Who killed Messiah? Messiah was killed, with a K-I-L-E-D, by Gentiles / priests. I misspelled priests. Oh, well, forgive me. Because the priesthood was the one who influenced people, said, as well as, don't we have the Pharisees there too, influenced and were pushing so much for his death. Who? God, with the Gibeonites, combined both the priesthood and Gentiles into one. Because they were servants and executed along with the priests, because they were serving the priesthood and doing their job. So he combined them into one group with the Gibeonites and said, look what they asked for, the death of the king's sons. Messiah killed death priests, kings, sons. See the symbolism going on? It's really quite talented what God did here. I'm floored when he does this. Five. Pierre Ann mentioned this. I don't know if it's absolutely right, but it's a fair question. So we have the two sons of Rizpah and the five of Merov. What does five mean? Torah. Which I think is a fair assessment. I forgot the gentleman's name you rattled off earlier, who argued the same thing with the five husbands and the lady with the Messiah talked to. But the number five, I'm running out of room here, so I'm going to scribble up top here, forgive me. So five sons and two sons. Both, of course, combined together is complete. They're both finished at seven. But the five sons, which should represent theoretically Torah, the five books of Moses, those of you who don't quite get that, what about them? Matter of fact, as Pierre had mentioned. What about the five descendants? Of the giant. The giant, the one who was killed, the reading the chapter. There's four sons here and Goliath makes five. As Pierre-Anne mentioned, David picked up five stones. And he said, in the name of God, you're going to die. What's the name of God as far as David's concerned? Well, in David's lifetime, the only word or known information of God is called the Torah. Everything else is history books. So, five sons and their mother didn't come. They had the Torah. The way of wording it. I think this is just an interesting conceptual idea. Not a proofed entry. The rest of it was stuff inside the chapter. This is an interesting concept. The number of five and the number of two. So we guess, or I guess, that the two associates Rizpah and Rachel together. That kind of makes sense to me. The five, the Torah is left alone. They're left alone to die. And no one mourns its loss. Except David. Because David saw what Rizpah was doing for technically all seven, but she was mostly focused upon the two, her two sons. He saw the love. He saw the respect. He then acted. He took the king and his sons and brought them back home. All their dead bodies. He brought them back home. When all was said and done, all the death was paid for, all the fixes happened, everything's done, he brought the king and his sons home, including, to my mind, the Torah. The law was brought home. The law was, there was an exile in Jabesh-Gilead, as Saul was, because he was not properly buried, was brought home, where it belonged. Yes, Ellie.
Which the rain comes.
And the rain comes.
When the Torah is back home, where it should be.
Yep. To me, personally speaking, the two sons being part of or associating Rizpah and Rizpah with Rachel also accomplished one other task. Two of the tasks. They completed the seven required, right? We have a completion, a payment, a fulfillment is done. To me, I could be wrong. To me, my opinion is that the two and the five, because after the Torah was done, Messiah dies, the 5,000 year mark, 4,000 year mark, blah, 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 and the 7,000 year mark when all is said and done, completes that the time cycle is finished. It's telling you that all this will occur at a period in time or a period of events. Personal opinion, of course. Yes,
okay.
Ellie.
If you, it's also possible you have a 7,000 years of history.
Right.
Okay, you'd have to have four. The division is wrong. Because
Match Messiah's thing. It's not going to be a three or four and three, not a five and two.
Right, but you've got the sons of
Benjamin,
Joseph and Benjamin, that in this 2,000 years time has taken preeminence of Christianity of sorts or of variations has taken preeminence since Messiah, but the numbers don't work.
Right. So, to me, I just associate primarily with the seven to complete the task, as well as to associate with get Rizpah and Rachel connected together, because you understand the mourning issues going there, and separate the five out of the two, because the five should be associated with, as other fives are, with the books with Moses or with God in general. Now, note, all of them, which means both five, both the books of Moses and the two, which you would argue two witnesses, if it doesn't make a difference, are all brought together back with the king. when he returns, no, in this case, King Saul, when he returns to home in Gibeah. Make sense? Any questions? Does it mean a whole lot? Well, God wrote it down. It's quite fascinating.
Yeah, clear as can be. Yeah, sure it is. I'll do those squirrely notes, clear as can be.
I find it fascinating what God did. No, this is different than the previous I talked about with Absalom and such. This is a different sequence of stuff being going on here. To me, I find more less detail on death of Messiah in this and more detail on God's actions in this. Me, personally speaking. Because I see what Messiah, the overarching, you know, complex goals he achieved, which is a little more different than Absalom, which is more the detailed events of his life. So this is just a fascinating story of what God did, but it also points to Messiah in every way you can imagine it. Have a wonderful rest of your Shabbat. Thank you for your time.